Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Act 46, the state's new school district consolidation law, has already become a key issue in Vermont's gubernatorial race. Some candidates want to repeal it. Some candidates want to make some changes to it. Democratic candidate Sue Minter says she supports most of the goals of Act 46, but there's one provision that she wants lawmakers to address during the 2016 session.
And I am also very opposed to the caps that were part of Act 46. I think they are going to be counterproductive to the difficult but important conversations we need to have about the future of education with declining enrollments, not just now but into the future.
How will Act 46 reduce property taxes if the main cost containment part of the law is taken out? That's one of the questions we have for our guest today, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Sue Minter. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. Great to have you here.
Thanks, Bob. It's great to be here.
You can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. What are the key issues that you want to see discussed in this year's gubernatorial race? Should candidates address ways to improve the state economy? How about the issue of property tax reform, the siting of renewable energy projects, perhaps the legalization of marijuana? Whatever is on your mind, the big issues that you think are facing the state of Vermont, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. You can always email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. Or give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Today's program is part of our continuing coverage of the 2016 governor's race. To date, we have had four of the major party candidates who have formally announced their candidacy on Vermont Edition. That would be Shap Smith, Matt Dunn, Phil Scott, and Bruce Lissman. Today, Sue Minter rounds out the field of five. But there are indications there might be more candidates in this race, and if they do announce, we'll have them on as well. Sue Minter has served as Transportation Secretary in the Shumlin administration. She was also the state's Chief Irene Recovery Officer in 2011. Prior to that, she represented Waterbury in the Vermont House. So before we discuss issues like Act 46 and renewable energy, tell us why you want to be governor.
You know, Bob, I think this is a really important election. We're really in a pivotal time here in Vermont and across the country with as we grow slowly out of the economic recession and we see poverty increasing. And I really feel that people are losing faith in government. And I want to change that as governor. I've had the opportunity through my experience as the Transportation Secretary and the Irene Recovery Officer to work with communities all across the state, large and small, and have really seen the challenges we face. And I'm a mom with two kids in the school, one finished and one still in, and I feel closely the economic anxiety about our future. And I think people through my work have recognized that I'm a problem solver. I'm very good at bringing people together to face our challenges. And as governor, I want to definitely focus on growing our economy with a 21st century infrastructure. I want to support working families, thinking about early childhood education and workforce training to get people the skills to rise out of poverty. And also to continue our green energy economy and protect our environment for the future.
You were talking about economic anxieties. I'm sure some people feel the cost of health care. So after 6 years of a Shumlin administration, why isn't Vermont working better? I've heard you say you want to make Vermont work again. Why is it not working now?
I think that there are so many factors that have affected our state, and in particular the recession. And I think as we grow slowly out of the recession, we need to continue to think differently. And that includes government itself. I'm very proud of the work that I've done in the Transportation Agency, frankly, not just in improving and making safer our roads and bridges and expanding transit and rail services and bike facilities, but in thinking about efficiency and government effectiveness. I'm proud of our accelerated bridge program, where we're building bridges using innovation. We're saving money, doing it more cost-effectively and more quickly. And I think efficiency and accountability to taxpayers is something we can do better throughout state government.
So as I mentioned, Peter Shumlin has served three terms as governor. You were a member of the administration, a member of the cabinet. Some people might thinking, well, if Sue Minter is elected governor, it's going to be the fourth term of the Shumlin administration. What would you say to that?
You know, I think the governor and I are very different people. We bring different experiences to the table and different leadership styles. I believe that people will really judge me based on my accomplishments. I've talked a little bit about transportation, but I think people know me also for my work as helping to lead the state after the worst disaster that faced us in nearly a century. It was an incredible, daunting opportunity, challenge. I worked across government agencies, partnerships with nonprofits, philanthropic organizations. We busted down silos, brought people together in new ways. And we did things that no one thought possible, you know, fixing 500 miles of damaged road in less than 4 months. We did it by thinking differently, acting differently, using partnerships, and being creative all the time with innovation. And I think those are the records of accomplishments that people will know me about, judge me for, and understand that I'm a leader who can actually solve problems and get things done.
Let's take a look at Act 46 and property tax reform. As you're well aware, Vermont school population has decreased by about 20,000 students in the last 15 years. As a result, Vermont has some pretty small school districts. In fact, of the state's 282 school districts, 231, or 80%, have fewer than 500 students. And 92 districts, or 33%, have fewer than 100 students. So Act 46 sets up a process to encourage and offer financial incentives to smaller districts to merge, and the goal is to have at least 900 students in all school districts. It is possible for a district to have fewer students if the district can prove that it's meeting certain quality standards, but if a smaller district doesn't meet those standards, then the State Board of Education can assign them to a new, larger district. You know, some people think this is the heavy hand of state government. This is Montpelier telling local communities what to do. In general, do you support the principles of Act 46?
I support the goals of improving quality and equity. But I certainly have problems with the key elements, certain elements of this proposal. And that's why I spoke so strongly in the introduction around the caps. You know, in our experience, my son is in high school at the Harwood Union District. And we are beginning to see the superintendent is doing a study to assess what those caps, those spending limits would do for our school. They would, unless we do a double tax burden on the taxpayers, the school would need to immediately cut in the range of $800,000, the elimination of 15 positions. I don't think that that's the kind of quality and improvement to education that Act 46 is intended to move us towards.
We should explain a little bit how the caps work. For the next 2 years, these caps, it's a variable cap. If you're in a high-spending town, then your budget is going to be capped at around 1%. For the towns in the middle, the cap would be between 2 and 3%, and low-spending towns would have a cap that could be 4 or 5%. And if you go over that, then you basically pay a double penalty to the state of Vermont. That's the double taxation that you were talking about. So backers of the bill last winter said you got to have these caps in order to control school costs until the larger bill and the larger law takes effect in a couple of years. So if you remove these caps, as you're suggesting, how are you going to control costs?
You know, again, we need to look at the impact of these decisions. So the cap is a very blunt instrument. It doesn't take into account the very unique circumstances that each school happens to find itself in at the time as they're looking at the spending allowance. So, for example, if a school had a significant increase, whether it was a building cost, a new boiler, or improvements that needed to be made in the last year, they're going to be hit more severely. And I think what we need to do, and this is what I do support with the proposal, is look at the district as a region. So for our Harwood district, for example, We have six different school boards. We're talking about a student population of 2,000, just about. Six school boards plus the union school board. That's seven different boards with seven different budgets. If we pull together and think about the region as a whole and have one budget, I believe we can have cost savings and efficiencies. Just imagine if you could share teachers, share cafeteria food services, do better sharing of transportation services, IT services. If you think about your regional assets and can budget across all of those, I believe that's where we can get in the long run those kinds of savings. And in some cases, like we saw with Chittenden East, they've saved a small school, the Smiley School, that was about to be closed, but now is being used for different purposes. And they've already found some cost savings even in their first year.
A lot of candidates are talking about the need to enact property tax reform, that property tax burdens across the state are really very, very high for a lot of folks. Is this law going to do enough to reduce property tax burdens, or is it just part of the solution and other steps are needed as well?
I think that's exactly what we don't know the answer to, Bob, and that's why we need to do the studies and we need to evaluate the opportunities for change in governance and budgeting, like I've discussed. But we need to have a sense of how it is going to affect, or whether it will or will not affect, property taxes, because that is the impetus. I think in some cases it will and can, but in other cases it may not. And that's why I'm concerned about the speed with which people are rushing forward in order to get those tax incentives, understandably. But this is not a short-term kind of decision. It takes thoughtful review analysis of what are the outcomes? What are the outcomes going to be for our tax rates, both locally, regionally, and across the state with changes? And most importantly, what about the students and the quality of education? Clearly, there will be benefits for some, but not for all.
Let's go to our callers and talk to Rick, who's calling from Plymouth. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you. I own a house in Plymouth, and I also sit on a couple of boards there. My question to people is that the Shumlin's administration program to fund all this education through our real estate tax has been a catastrophic failure for everybody. We are losing not only all our young people, but the old people are being forced into bankruptcy. I really believe somebody has got to get up, have the courage, and deal with the real estate tax issue immediately. I disagree with our speaker right now about this, because this is what's killing Vermont. You know, you're going to turn Vermont into a welfare state by doing this. If you do not address our real estate tax burden immediately, no more time for discussion, no more time for these long-term plans. Do it now, because I'm hearing so much anger towards the Shumlin administration, and I'd be honest with you, he would not have gotten in for another term.
Okay, Rick, we appreciate your call. I think Rick is talking about the property transfer tax. Is that it, or is he talking? Rick, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
So, Rick, are you talking about property tax burdens in general, or are you, when you said real estate tax, I was thinking you might have meant the property transfer tax. Which one, or perhaps both?
That was good, yeah. Our real estate taxes we pay on our properties right now. Yes, sir.
Okay, general property.
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay. Thank you, Rick. So there it is. I mean, there are probably a lot of people feeling the way that Rick does, that property taxes are really quite high and that something has to be done about it. But you're feeling there's no quick fix here.
Well, I absolutely hear it far and wide that property taxes are going up and too quickly, and that for some it means trying to move out of state. I think there's a lot of factors involved, but we do need to look at what's driving those property taxes. And I will say that this has been a funding situation since Act 60, Act 68 was put into place in 2002, I believe, was Act 68. So it's taken place over a long period of time. And I want to say that one of the big drivers is what is school spending, what's driving school spending? And going back, frankly, to those caps, right now health care costs for schools is in close to 8% increase or 7% increase. And so that's an increase that the school budgets, school boards can't affect. But also, I think it's fair to point out that there are many, many more services that schools are having to provide, really social services, frankly, dealing with family issues, drug and alcohol abuse, many challenges. And one question that should be raised is the property tax the right way to be funding those services? Have we put too much onto that property tax? So I appreciate the anger, the frustration. It is not simple to change that tax. Many people have looked to, can we use the income tax? I think that you would have to have some level of property tax to ensure stability, but perhaps there is a different way to look at funding some of those more increasing, highly increasing social services and the cost to do that that schools are taking on.
Would it be too simple to say that one of the reasons that education costs are going up per pupil spending is we've got 20% fewer students than we had 15 years ago. We haven't had a corresponding drop in the number of teachers. So our per pupil costs have really skyrocketed over the last 15 years.
Absolutely. And it is true that we haven't just had a significant decline in the last decade. We are projected to continue that decline. And that, again, is why we have to think about how we are funding and budgeting for our schools. Are there schools that aren't meeting educational quality and are very costly precisely because of the few students in the school? And do we need, as a community and as a state, to move to a different system or where we combine more of the smaller schools when they're not meeting educational quality and so that we can reach those goals to both improve quality and equity of our school system and, yes, hopefully reduce the property tax burden. But it won't be the only thing that's going to reduce property taxes, just as the caller pointed out.
Sounds like you're open to the possibility of a different funding source or an additional funding source, perhaps looking at the income tax. That's something that members of the Vermont House have looked at for a number of years. Is that a possibility?
I think we have to think differently. This is not working, and I think it's both how we're structuring schools, the spending that schools are doing, and whether we can adjust that based on the size of the districts, if that improves quality. But maybe it's also another look at the formula, the income sensitivity, whether we can move away from a cliff so that there's more of a balance of who is paying into the Ed Fund and possibly more resources into the Ed Fund as well.
Well, on that subject, let's talk to Chip in West Burke. Hi, Chip. What's on your mind?
Hi. It's actually West Rutland, but that's fine. I just wanted to talk about the income sensitivity. I believe the threshold is $95,000. I could be wrong, but that seems high to me. I don't know what it should be. That's above my pay grade. And, you know, I desperately want to support Sue. I think she did a great job with the Agency of Transportation. And Irene, you know, she's obviously a well-educated woman. And I don't know why we have so many teachers. My wife is a retired teacher for about 6 years now, and she substituted for a very short time, and she came home and said, I had kindergarten today. I said, oh, nice. She said, I had 5 students and 2 aides. She said, do you remember my first year teaching 35 years ago? She had 19 kindergarten kids in the morning and 18 in the afternoon by herself. And yes, that's 35 years ago, and that might sound like a long time, but it really isn't. And I would just like to hear Sue address those issues. I think she already did, but like I said, I desperately want to support her. I'm trying to do that. So thank you.
Chip, I just had a quick question for you. Was it your belief that the program of income sensitivity is too generous right now?
It is my belief, yes. I think a person or a family that makes $95,000 ought to be able to pay their property taxes. You know, I don't participate in it. You know, I've been blessed. I make well over that, and that's all well and good. But, you know, I don't care if they have four kids. That wasn't my, you know, we know what causes that. You know, that wasn't my problem. I think if you make $90,000, $95,000, you ought to be able to pay your property taxes. If not, you're in too much of a house. That's all.
Okay, Chip, we appreciate your phone call. Chip is thinking that income sensitivity, the system why people pay their school taxes based on their income and not the value of their property, he thinks it's too generous. I got the impression, listening to you a few moments ago, you'd like to expand it.
Oh, no. What I was saying is, I think, Chip, that we are actually on the same page in terms of one of the challenges is that fewer and fewer Vermonters are paying more and more into the system because they are not eligible. First of all, there's fewer people and they're not eligible for the sensitivity. So what I'm saying is there's two things we need to do. First, to address the point he made about the kindergartens or the small schools. As we've discussed, we have to be thinking differently about where everybody is in school, if there are schools that are too small and quality of education is impaired. You know, there's other ways to think differently. I just want to mention, because I've had great conversations with people, and are there different ways to use some of our schools as intergenerational facilities, for example? Could we be pairing some of the small school kindergartens? Obviously, the hardest thing that communities are dealing with is moving facilities for educating our youngest children away, further away from home. But if we could actually make use of that building, half of it for schools and half of it for seniors and adult education and other uses for those facilities that help reduce the cost burden of keeping that building going, it's just an interesting idea. Another idea I've thought about is, could we actually try to bring international students to Vermont more? We have great schools, and we do have something that a lot of people around the world are willing to pay a lot for, which is learn English in a great school and a great community. We could possibly, on schools with schools on the bubble of not having enough students, actually get international students and families to pay to actually fill out that enrollment. So it's thinking differently, and yes, going into the formula, whether it's income sensitivity or how we're paying, and think differently there as well. It hasn't been a place we've been willing to or able to make a lot of change, and I think we have to look at it all.
Today in the program, our guest is Democratic gubernatorial candidate Sue Minter. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. When we come back, we're going to talk about renewable energy. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today is Democratic gubernatorial candidate Sue Minter. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk about renewable energy just for a moment. I'd like to get your thoughts about some of the solar and wind power projects that have been proposed for Vermont. And I'm wondering, in your mind, do you think a project could be too big? And I'm referring now to several projects. There are 20-megawatt solar projects. The governor said this week, hey, that's too big. He's a big supporter of solar projects, but he says that's out of character for the state of Vermont. He doesn't want to have those big solar projects here. What do you think?
Well, two things. I want to just start by saying I do support solar energy investments and believe that this is an important part of our economy, not only because it supports our environment and reduces Vermonters' costs for spending and keeps money in the local economy, but because it's new jobs. You know, I want to mention that the clean energy sector in Vermont grew by 6% last year, and it currently supports over 16,000 jobs. So it is an important element of our economy and has many important benefits. That said, I also am concerned about the mega scale solar, not just the scale and impact to community, but how that facility would really become a single generating source. And I don't think that's the kind of solar investments that I would be interested in. I'm looking more towards community solar, community-based solar. I know for sure that we are having issues, a bumpy ride right now with respect to the siting of those facilities. And I think it is very important that towns be given party status in the Section 248 process, as has now begun. I think it's very important for people to have a voice in the process. And I think we would all benefit from a better regional analysis of where siting, facility siting would be beneficial in terms of the resource, but also the location, so that we start to establish better siting criteria and we don't have so many visceral reactions to the new developments. And I think the scale of the facility that is being considered would really put us back in terms of people's willingness to continue to move forward on solar.
Do you think towns should have the final say on whether or not a solar or wind project is sited in their community? Should they have veto power? Because right now there's some of them are saying, well, you give us a greater voice, but in the end, Public Service Board is going to do whatever it wants to do, and it's kind of an all or nothing situation for them. So should they have veto power?
You know, I wouldn't support the undermining of the Section 248 process for a system of that is has a public good, such as an energy facility siting. But I do believe that they should be given voice and haven't yet. So this is new and important, and they will play a role, especially when towns can come with their own siting criteria. So that we have some system across the state where people can agree what's reasonable and what is not reasonable. I think that's the kind of conversation we have all the time in Vermont, and we need to come together and really advance this. That's why I'm supporting the work that the Public Service Department is funding for, I believe, three different regional planning commissions to actually look at what does it mean to try to achieve our energy goals, and where would there be facilities that we could site that wouldn't cross those important boundaries of what's a reasonable criteria for siting. Because we want to make sure this industry succeeds, and we don't want it there to be a backlash.
While we're talking about energy, some lawmakers are backing a plan to impose an 88 cents per gallon carbon tax as a way to encourage energy efficiency and reduce carbon emissions. And they say 90% of the new revenue will be used to lower taxes for low and middle income people. And the sales tax rate could actually be reduced from 6% to 5%. The remaining revenue would be used to fund energy conservation programs and for developing a bigger infrastructure for public transportation. Do you support the imposition of a carbon tax?
Well, you know, I think that carbon emissions and climate change is really one of the biggest challenges facing not just Vermont and our region, but our entire globe. And I do see that pricing strategies can help change consumption habits and move us in that direction. But I would support a regional approach to this problem. I actually, as Secretary of Transportation, worked with colleagues across the New England region on something called the Transportation Climate Initiative. We've seen how REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, has helped our region in a same reduce carbon through the electric center sector by acting regionally. We've seen a cap and trade opportunity happen for carbon from the petroleum sources of carbon on the West Coast. So I think we would be better off looking regionally at that same approach that we've used as REGI for electric and use it for petroleum-based sources, just as the Western State Initiative has done.
So you think it's a mistake for Vermont to go it alone?
I think we're going to get a lot more benefit and a lot more opportunity in terms of shifting costs and consumption when we look at the regional scale.
You know, you've talked about your role in transportation, and at your campaign kickoff, you talked about investing more in the state's transportation infrastructure. What do you have in mind? What's the scope of what you want to do, and where's that money going to come from?
Great question. Thank you for asking. What I'm really noticing and what I've learned is that when we actually have strategic investments, especially in our downtowns and built areas, and I'm not just speaking about transportation investments, and I'm not just talking about one form of federal and state dollars. I'm looking across sectors, the way we did in Barrie and in St. John's Barrie and in Winooski as just three examples, where the public sector investment in water, sewer, wastewater, stormwater, and a new main street, which is pedestrian-oriented, has created a new environment for private sector investment. And it's been very successful. In Barrie, $19 million of public investment has leveraged over $45 million in private investment. And that community has really transformed from a place with, you know, empty storefronts to now a very vibrant community. It's been infrastructure investment. It's been state buildings, the Department of Education there now. It's also been brownfields, EPA investments. So when we come together with state and federal investments across the board and we strategically invest in an area, we can have a very significant stimulus effect on that economy. The same, very similar situation in St. Albans. There we had $13 million of public investment, which has leveraged now $16 million in private investment. And their grand list is growing. It's commercial, it's manufacturing, it's retail, and it's the more people moving to that community. It's creating great communities. And you know what? That's what we need for the future of our economy, because we're a rural state. In fact, we're the second most rural state in the country. And as you look across the country, rural states are in decline. They're in population decline and economic decline. We've got to make sure that we grow our centers and make them great places to live so that business will want to move here and grow and prosper here, but that future Vermonters or young Vermonters also want to move here, because it is having a great place to live and a workforce for quality employers to come that's going to make our economy sing into the future.
So do you do that within the existing budget of the transportation agency, or do you need to appropriate some new money to make this happen?
I think we can first look at what we have and invest not just transportation, but look at the monies that are going into the Commerce Department. For example, the Community Development Block Grant dollars, looking at the monies going to the Agency of Natural Resources from the EPA for brownfield development, and partner with the private sector. And when you do a multi-sector approach, and you strategically focus on one place rather than spreading the money everywhere, you actually have a much more significant impact. That's what we did with Irene. Think about it. We had so much to do all at once, and we were all in. And it was very strategic, and we had priorities, and we followed those, and we succeeded in meeting our goals. It's because we put all of our focus in one area and accomplished great things. And that's the kind of work we need to do. It isn't just government. It's a private partner. It's a partnership between the private sector, the public sector, and the philanthropic community to make places stronger and to grow our economy.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Peter in Brattleboro. Hey, Peter, welcome to the program.
Thanks. This is a great show with a lot of good comments and issues. I did not hear Sue Minter talk when she was down in Brattleboro recently, but I just read the write-up in the Commons, the little local newspaper. And it talks about her position on quite a few different issues, including gun safety. And she says there that she intends to focus on preventing gun violence. I've asked this question of both the other Democratic candidates on the VPR interview and didn't really get an answer. And my question is whether or not Sue Minter will support universal background checks for all gun sales in the state of Vermont. I hope she can address that specifically.
Okay, Peter, thanks for your phone call.
Yes, thank you very much. And I did have a great visit in Brattleboro. And with respect to guns, I have said, as I said at that meeting, I respect, of course, the Second Amendment of the Constitution. I support Vermonters' right to own guns. But I don't think we're immune from gun violence and think we do need to think about gun safety and prevention. And I support what the legislature did last year to help align us with other states to keep guns out of the hands of the most dangerous felons. And given that federally licensed gun sellers have to do background checks currently, which is most of the gun sales in Vermont, I think it makes sense for us to have a conversation about making that true for all gun sales.
We'll certainly be following the people and issues of Campaign 2016 in the weeks and months ahead. Sue Minter, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you, Bob. Great to be here, and thanks all for listening.
Coming up next, I'll talk with former Governor Madeleine Cunin about why she feels the fortunes of Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton have improved dramatically in just the past few weeks. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The presidential campaign of former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has seen a big boost in the last few weeks. Clinton had a strong performance at the first Democratic candidates debate. Vice President Joe Biden decided not to enter the race. And Clinton got some good reviews following her 11-hour appearance in front of a special House Benghazi committee. Recently, her poll numbers in Iowa and New Hampshire have also showed some strong improvement. At the same time, Bernie Sanders is telling voters that he has some important issue differences with Clinton. With us now to look at the 2016 presidential race is former Governor Madeleine Cunin, who is a spokesperson for the Clinton campaign in Vermont. Governor, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So, Governor, it seemed like at the beginning of this month, there were a lot of concerns among many Democrats about the strength of Hillary Clinton's campaign. The controversy surrounding her emails as Secretary of State continued to dog her. Her poll numbers were falling. How important have the last few weeks been for the Clinton campaign?
Oh, I think they've been very important because they've revealed the real Hillary Clinton. I think people had some doubts because they were sort of blinded by the email controversy, which, you know, was blown up to huge proportions. And as Bernie said, I'm sick of these darn emails. And that was one of the highlights of the presidential debate. But I think what you've seen in the last couple of weeks, that she is composed, she is smart, she is totally briefed on the issues, and she's presidential, which is the big question. Can you imagine her in the Oval Office making decisions that affect our lives?
Governor, this week we also saw Bernie Sanders articulate some key issue differences that he thinks he has with Hillary Clinton. And the first involves same-sex marriage. He says he's been a longtime supporter of same-sex marriage. He points out that Hillary Clinton actually backed the passage of the Defense of Marriage Act back in 1996, and that law expressly defined marriage as a bond between a man and a woman, and it allowed individual states to refuse to recognize same-sex marriage licenses from other states. So he argues that his position didn't, quote, evolve on this issue. He had the correct position right from the start. Does he have a point?
Well, he has a small point, but, you know, the real question is, where do you stand now as you prepare for the presidency? And, you know, a lot of people evolved, frankly, on that issue. The whole nation did. I mean, we would never have dreamt that the Supreme Court would ratify or would come out an endorsement of same-sex marriage. So it's been a huge transition in our society and probably one of the fastest in terms of a social issue that has ever taken place. And it's all to the good. So she's not alone in her evolution. I don't think it makes a difference whether you stood for that position in 1996 or 2015. The important thing is what you're saying now and what you will do as president.
Sanders also points out that he voted against the Iraq War. while Hillary Clinton voted for it. He says that's a very important distinction. What do you say about that?
Well, it was a mistake, and she has said as much. And again, you know, people don't always make perfect decisions, and she based her decision on the information that she had at that time, which turned out not to be accurate. So I don't think that's a fair judgment point, because, you know, what will she do in the next crisis? And we know that the next president is going to face some very tough national security and foreign policy decisions. And she brings so much experience to foreign policy. I mean, we couldn't imagine somebody more qualified in that regard, having served as Secretary of State. So I think she has the judgment. I think she learned from the Iraq vote. And I think she knows the global landscape, you know, where the hot spots are, who's in charge. You can't imitate that experience by coming out and still pushing that old button of the Iraq vote.
Sanders also says that, in part on based on the Iraq vote, that Hillary Clinton would be much more likely to get the United States involved in an overseas conflict. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
No, I don't, because, you know, nobody knows what lies ahead for this country. And to predict what somebody else is going to do is just not quite fair. I mean, you could turn around and say Bernie Sanders won't take action when action is needed. We have to trust the person who is president and who is the next Secretary of State to make the right decisions. And so I don't think she's more aggressive. I think she's realistic. I think she's practical. And I think she will be very well equipped to make those tough decisions when they occur.
In your mind, is there a danger for Hillary Clinton if Sanders sharpens his criticism about her on some of these key issues?
Well, you know, Sanders said at the outset he's not going to be negative. He's not going to go into attack mode. And I believe he'll stick to that. But some differences have to be pointed out. And, you know, Sanders is to the left of Hillary. We all know that. But, you know, Hillary is not only running to win the primary, she's also running to win the general election. And I think that her positions are really closer in many ways to winning the general election, where voters will be more moderate in their beliefs.
You know, Governor, some political observers think that Hillary Clinton is moving to the left on a number of issues in order to cut into Sanders' base of support. They think that this could actually hurt her in a general election, much in the same way that Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney got hurt in 2012 by shifting too far to the right in order to win the GOP nomination. Is there a danger there for Hillary Clinton?
I think she's well aware of that. You know, you're sort of damned if you do and damned if you don't. And to find the exact sweet spot where you should be, both for the primary and for the general election, is not easy. But on issues like gun control, she's taking a brave position, no doubt, and taking on the NRA. And, you know, I recall when Bernie was the darling of the NRA when he first ran for Congress and beat Peter Smith. So I think some of those decisions and differences are important. You know, some people will obviously criticize her for that. But I think, again, that's an issue where opinion has begun to shift, where people are strongly in favor, or a majority is in favor, of background checks. And that's a position she holds and has held.
Governor, recent polls also suggest that a majority of voters simply don't trust Hillary Clinton. So how can she overcome this negative perception?
Well, you know, the question of trust depends upon how it's asked. I think after her performance in the past 2 weeks, that has really moved into the background. It's not up front. And the question is, you know, do you trust the person who has their finger on the button in terms of nuclear war? Do you trust the person to make the right decision on terrorism? Do you trust the person to continue to protect the most vulnerable in our society? And that's the real question of trust.
And, Governor, as you look at this Republican field, which candidate do you think would give Hillary Clinton the toughest fight in a campaign for president?
Well, it's pretty hard to tell because there's a, you know, there's 10 of them that were up there last night, and it's difficult. I think probably if I were to guess right now, I would probably say Rubio, though he also has great vulnerabilities in terms of his finances and the positions he's taken and the votes he's not been in Congress for. But I think she'd be well prepared to take anybody on because the differences with all of them are so clear.
Former Governor Madeleine Cunin is a spokesperson for Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign in Vermont. Governor, many thanks for being on the program today.
My pleasure, Bob.
That's our program for today. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sangari and Sam Gale Rosen. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.